On this edition of Celebrating Science, Raymond LaFlamme on quantum computing. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation. In this presentation, Harnessing the Quantum World, Professor Raymond LaFlamme explains quantum computation and shows how to manipulate quantum bits of information in experiments. Professor LaFlamme began his career working with Stephen Hawking on quantum gravity and cosmology, and is now a leading theorist and experimentalist in the fields of quantum information and quantum computing. He is the director of the Institute for Quantum Computing and an associate faculty member at Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics.
I'd like to start tonight by telling a story which has happened to me 25 years ago, pretty much to the day, when I was having lunch with my grandfather. I was coming back from university, where I had heard my first talk on relativity, the special theory of relativity. And I told them that I'd learned that packed in atoms, in the nucleus of atoms, there's an incredible amount of energy. And if we could harness this energy, wonderful things could happen related to the future of our society. And he looked at me and he said, "Yes, I know that." He was somebody who read a lot, was very cultured. And he told me that 75 years from now, you know, in 1929, he was coming back from his honeymoon in Paris. He was in the boat, and in the boat, he had seats being assigned. And next to him, there was a physicist who had was coming back from Paris and had learned that indeed the theory of special relativity told us that inside atoms, there's lots and lots of energy. And this man had told me that this could change the landscape of the future. And we know now that it certainly changed the landscape of politics in the 20th century. I'm here to tell you tonight that we are beginning the 21st century, and there's opportunities who are coming to us. And one of them is to understand and control the world of quantum mechanics. And this can lead to a very different view in the future than what we have seen in the past. A new technology which is very, very different from the one that we have had around us up to now. And this is what I'm going to go and talk about. My grandfather is going to be 99 in March. And I'd like to dedicate this lecture to him, as he had a long-lasting impression on me. So what I'm going to talk about tonight will be divided in three parts. The first part will be to tell you why should we be interested in quantum information and using information which is based on very small system where the laws of physics are changing and they are ruled by quantum mechanics. And then I will tell you a little bit about what is this quantum computing, how does that work? And I finally will tell you about steps toward building some of these devices, in fact, and one in particular based on nuclear magnetic resonance. Information processing devices are pervasive in our society, from $5 watches to multi-billion dollar satellites, without forgetting, of course, being in Waterloo, the BlackBerry. All these devices are really changing the way we do accounting, the way the economy works, the way that we are doing science, the way we're entertaining ourselves. And ultimately, I believe is going to change the way we think and who we are. All this revolution that we've seen around us is based on what is called the digital revolution or the digital information. This is information which is encoded in bits or in zeros and one, physical systems which can be in two states, either in the zero or in the one. And by manipulating strings of these bits, using the classical laws of physics, we can compute, or by sending these bits to some other people, we can communicate. But we know that the laws of classical physics are only approximations to the true laws of nature. There are better approximations when we go to very small systems, the ones of governed by quantum mechanics. And you can encapsulate all my lecture tonight into one question. Would these new laws of physics, due to quantum mechanics, would there be an impediment to manipulate information? Or can we turn them into an advantage? There are two fundamental reasons why we should be interested in quantum mechanics for information processing. And the first one is, we have no choice. We are going there. Why is that? It is because every time you use a computer or an information processing device, they never do what you really want them to do. They are doing some kind of approximation of what you want to do, and for most of the time, it's fine. But if you really would like to improve these devices so that they really do what you would like to do, at the end, you don't want to go and type on your keyboard. It would be really great if it goes and compute exactly when you think about it. That would be the ultimate computer. But this idea of these devices doing only approximation of your problem is not new. As soon as people built computers, electronic computers 50 years ago, people try to make them faster and better so that we can loosen these approximations and get nearer to what we really want them to do. And so the computing industry has been trying to make computers faster and better. And the way they've tried to do this, or the way they've done this, is by making transistors, like really the brain of the computer, smaller. So the bits of information gets nearer to each other, so it's faster to communicate with each other. In the mid-1960s, Gordon Moore, who was chairman of Intel Corporation, realized that every 18 months, we can pack twice as many transistors per unit area. What he realized was that between 1950 to 1965, people were better and better and better at making smaller computers. You can see here the vacuum tubes of the computers of the end of the 40s, beginning of the 50s. Here, chips of about five years ago. People have been able to pack these things better and better. When Gordon Moore said that we can pack twice as many transistors per unit area, he said maybe that will be true in the future. Well, he went to see friends, CEOs of big companies, and they all laughed because he had only a few data points around here. And with 3 or 4 points, you can make any kind of extrapolation that you would like to. But it turned out that he is the one who had the last laugh, because that was true in the 70s, that was true in the 80s, it was true in the 90s, it has been true until 2004. Every 18 months, we can pack twice as many transistors per unit area. And recently, Intel suggested that it'll be true until about 2010. I'm going to make the hypothesis that Moore's law, which has been true for the last 50 years, will be true for the next 15 years, up to 2020. And if you look at this diagram, what you see around there is that you get transistors the size of atoms. As we go down to that level, the laws of physics are going to start to change. In fact, we already see some quantum effects in transistors today. What we try to do with them right now is to get rid of them. They are troublesome. They make us do things in a slightly different way. We have been incredibly successful for the last 50 years. So let's try to get rid of them. But if you want to get rid of them, as time will keep on, you'll need to understand quantum mechanics better and better to be able to get rid of these effects. The ideas of quantum computing is to think of these effects not as an impediment, but try to take advantage of them. Quantum mechanics was discovered at the turn of the last century, around 1900. People were trying to do experiments. They were trying to explain them using the laws of classical physics, the laws of Newton, the laws of Maxwell, the laws which essentially govern everything on the macroscopic world that we have around us. the laws that govern your car when you drive around. But when they went to a very small system, these laws started to fail, and they replaced it by a new set of laws. For the first 50 years of quantum mechanics, it was a bit like a descriptive science. It was a bit like astronomy. People would do experiments and say, yes, with this new theory, we can explain this, and we can explain this, we can explain this phenomena. In the 1950s, things started to change. People started to realize that there's some small effect that they could harness, which turned into technology. There's three of them that we know very well around us today. The transistor that I've mentioned has a little bit of quantum effect in it. Although it manipulates classical information, information which is encoded in bits, which can be in zero or one. But it does use a little bit of quantum effects to do this transformation of zero into one at some point. The laser, like the little laser pointer that I have in my hand, use some quantum effects. MRI, magnetic resonance imaging machines, they have some a little bit of quantum effects, but we were not able to control them on a very large scale, and that's what we're trying to do today. To understand a little bit why quantum mechanics is so different, we can think of an experiment with light, in fact, light from a laser. The idea is to shine a source on a screen which has two little slits, a top one and a bottom one, and look what is the effect on the screen at the end. If we take, we put something on the first, the bottom slit, and then we look at the effect, we get a certain pattern of the intensity of light as it goes. If we block the top slit and look at, let that one open, we get another pattern here in red. So naively, you would think of putting the two together, you'll get this pattern of just adding both of them. Turns out that this is not what is happening. We don't get the pattern here in the black, but the one in the blue. And this can be explained by thinking of light as a wave. A little movie here show the top slit being open, the light would come in, we get a certain pattern. The bottom slit, another pattern of light coming in, and a certain pattern of intensity will arrive at the end. But if we put those two things together, what we see is the interference between the wave of the slit at the top and the bottom. And because the wave has parts which are going up, parts which goes bottom, which are minus, they cancel each other when they go on top of each other. And that led to the interference, some zeros in the intensity that you can see here. So from this, people concluded that light behaves like waves. But more experiments started to make this a little bit more troublesome. When you go to very low intensity of light, and lower intensity, certainly the wave or the light start to behave like particles. Think a little bit like if you go down and look at waves to very, very small level where atoms start to see, then these things are made of particles. And there are some experiments, in fact, an experiment due to, which was explained by Einstein in 1921, for which he got the Nobel Prize, which is called the photoelectric effect, showed that really when you go to low intensity, suddenly light behaves like particles that we call photons. So instead of getting to lower and lower intensity of light as you go down, suddenly these particles are becoming rarer in what you are when you send them. So let's think about the experiment where we're going to reduce the intensity of this light here so that not more than one particle is going to go at a time. And the question is the particle going to go through the top slit or the bottom slit? So if you block the bottom slit, what you see, if you go slowly and send one photon and another one and another one, then they start to be scattered on the screen at the back, and they form a certain pattern which corresponds to the one, the top slit here, with the intensity. You do the same thing with the bottom slit, and a very similar pattern. These photons randomly start to kind of put around, but with a pattern which is focused, which reproduces this curve here. But the real question is, what happens when both slits are open? Initially, it's look random, but when you have enough photons which has passed through, the interference pattern starts to appear. And this is incredibly puzzling, because you send only one particle at a time, so they cannot have talked to each other. So how do we explain this? And the way we explain this is that these photons can be at two places at the same time. They can pass through the two slits in one shot. And this is really mind-boggling, and physicists are still puzzled about this. And if you ask me, do you really believe that photons can be at two places at the same time? The answer is yes. And why is that? Because I do this experiment again and again and again, and I get the same result. And the only way you can explain it is, indeed, these particles can be at two places at the same time. I once told this to my son, Patrick. And he told me, if I would be quantum mechanics, does that mean that when I go to school, I can be in the schoolyard at the same time? He thought he would give a much more optimistic view of school if he can do this. But I thought it was very good, because his mind was to really capture the essence of quantum mechanics and turn it into something useful. So what we get from this is that if we go down to quantum systems, they behave both as wave and particles. And when we look at the particle part of this, they can be at two places at the same time, or more than one place at once. Start to think about what we would do if we would try to manipulate information. I mentioned to you that bits of information are physical system, are encoded in physical system, such that the bit is either in zero or one. And if we can turn this using the laws of quantum mechanics, we can be at zero and one at the same time. Maybe we can take advantage of this. And we'll see that indeed this is the case. There's another property of quantum mechanics, which I'll just mention in passing. You might have been looking at this and say, can we do an experiment so that we put a little detector near one of those fringe or one of those slit, and we'll know if the photon passes there or not? And if you try to do this, what you'll learn is quantum mechanics has a rule that if you try to observe a system, you cannot do it without perturbing it. And the interference pattern is going to be modified because of this interaction. And so you cannot get around and try to be very smart and get around nature and find from which slit it has passed. You won't be able to find it out. In fact, this very simple idea that looking at a quantum system always leave a fingerprint can be turned also into a technology, which is called quantum cryptography. And there, the idea is to exchange a key between two people and try to find if there's an eavesdropper in the middle who tries to detect the information which is being sent. And there are technologies today which do exactly this. But I'm not going to talk any more about this in the future, although I'll talk about cryptography again in a few minutes. So what are the implications of using a different set of rules for computation? To re-understand this, I'll back up a little bit and again go back to history. The idea of using physical laws around us to compute is not new. The idea of an abacus is the idea of using physical system to help us to compute. Charles Babbage, in the 1830s and 40s, had the idea of making a mechanical device to help us to compute. And a device which is called MIT's Mechanical Mind in 1920s was an idea of, again, put gears together and help us to compute. I've put this because I really like this idea of a mechanical mind, something with a bunch of gears together which make things happen as we kind of turn around. Very strict and kind of not much creativity on the end, at the input of this. But things changed dramatically in the 30s. And the reason why this change came from a problem in mathematics. At the turn of the 20th century, at the beginning of the 1900s, mathematicians were really worried about something which was realized was creeping up in human language. Sentences which don't make sense. An example of this is the following sentence. The statement is false. If you look at it, it's nonsense. Why? Because if it is a true statement that I've just said, it is written here that it is false. And if this is a false statement, I've just said something which is true. So it's a self-referential sentence, which just kind of doesn't make sense at all. And the mathematicians were worried that maybe sentences like this would creep up in mathematics, and we'd have proofs which would contradict themselves. You can imagine when you go and talk to the income tax people and tell them that their statement is true and false at the same time. So Hilbert was asked in 1900 to give a series of lectures of the 10 most important problems in mathematics for the 20th century. And his problem number two was called the compatibility of the arithmetical axioms, which was try to show that these kind of things don't creep up in mathematics. And so mathematicians went around and they tried to demonstrate this by starting with a set of very small assumptions that everybody would agree, show that you can never end up with contradiction. And to the amazement of the whole mathematical community in the 1930s, Kurt Gödel, who was in Princeton, showed that this was impossible to show that there would never be contradictions. In fact, what he showed is that you would always find a statement like the one which was in blue. You could always construct a statement such that it cannot be proved wrong or true, true or false. And this really puzzled the mathematician, and then there's still repercussion of this today. There was another group who was interested in this, was Turing, Church and his student Turing. And in fact, they proved something very, very similar theorem in the 1930s, but they were not the first one to discover it, so they are not as famous for that part. But in doing so, they were trying to think of, let's try to take the human element out of making proof in mathematics. Let's think about the device we would make our proof. So then we won't have to worry if at some point the human comes in and kind of believes something is true or sneaks something in. So they were thinking about the machine who would compute or make proof for us. And that led to what is called the Turing machine. The idea was essentially a tape with a head on it which will manipulate information. And this information can be kind of stored in one place. You can go and retrieve it. Then you can manipulate it. And you have a series of instructions at the bottom, and which would tell you what to do with this machine. And this turned out to be the blueprint for computers, the idea of having a program in there, of having information we can store and kind of being put back, manipulated in a certain place. And I found it really amazing that a fundamental problem of mathematics, something that we think is done only in some white towers of universities, turned out to lead to the most important technological invention in the 20th century. And the work of Church and Turing led to in the 1950s and 60s to a science called complexity theory, which was, with these machines and with the computers which were started to appear, can we assess the amount of resources that different problems are going to use? So the idea was to look at problem which scales. And the scale, in example of problem right here, is adding numbers. The scale is how many digit do you want to add. And what these people working in this theory had to say is, for adding, we need this amount of resources. And then if we do factors, I give you 15, you have to tell me 5 and 3. So the scale here is how many digit I describe the input. You give me how many digits it takes to solve the problem. Traveling salesperson is another problem, where we have a traveling person, certain number of cities to go and visit, and you want to find the shortest path. And the question is, let's characterize how much resources. And the physicist's interpretation of these computer scientists working in complexity theory is that they found two categories of problems, the hard ones and the easy ones. So the hard ones are characterized in an exponential amount of resources, like 2 to the power n, where n is our scale. That, and this exponential means it's going incredibly fast, very, very fast. And they are the easy problem. It doesn't grow that fast, polynomial amount of resources. And with this characterization, and this characterization is very robust, even if you change little details here or there, all the problems are still in two kind of categories. And I should mention that problems like adding turns out to be easy problems. Traveling salesmen are known to be hard problems. Factoring, We're not totally sure. We have not proved that they are really hard. But what we know is that we don't have an easy algorithm for them. And this problem is going to come back in a few minutes. So with this, the computer scientists proclaim a principle called a strong Church-Turing principle, saying that there's no machine who can turn a hard problem into an easy one. And this is really at the foundations of computer science. You have your first course of computer science, you learn this. It's a little bit like in chemistry, where they tell you that you cannot turn dirt into gold. Like, there's no magic recipe. This is the equivalent for computer science. And why do I bring this today? It's because quantum computing is really telling us or putting doubts in this strong Church-Turing principle. By using these different set of rules, we believe there are problems which seems to be hard, which are turned to be easy. It's really fundamentally changed what we understand by information. It is changing the way of how we manipulate it and all the possibilities of what we can do with this information. By changing the set of rules from classical to quantum, there is a fundamental difference on how we can manipulate this information. So I'll give you an example. I mentioned you to factoring. So Peter Shor, who was working at the AT&T in 1994, discovered that if you try to factor a number, which is the product of two primes, 15, which is equal to 5 times 3, if you try to do this on a quantum on a classical computer, the amount of resources is the exponential of the number of digit L that it takes to express N. So it is increasing very fast. If you try to do this on a quantum computer, he showed that you could do this with an amount of resources which is not very large, like L to the power cube, a polynomial. So you might say, that's interesting. But again, who cares about factoring numbers? Well, it turns out that probably most of you, or many of you, have used the difficulty of factoring in the last few days. Because the difficulty of breaking or finding the factors of a number is equivalent of breaking a cryptographical code called RSA, or Rivet-Shamir-Adelman system. If you log in on a web, on a website, such that you have a security in it where there's a S on the after the HTTP, HTTPS, and S is for secure, what really the system does is that it does send you a large number N. And with this large number N, you can encrypt your credit card. And then you can send it back to the company, and which has kept P and Q closed to itself. And then with this, with P and Q, they can go and find what is the number of your credit card. Anybody between you and the company can intercept an encrypted version of your credit card. But to find the number of your credit card, they need to find a factor. It turns out that the largest computers in the world can factor about 150 digits, the largest. So if you take a number N, which has more than 150 digits, you're secure for the moment, as long as we don't have a quantum computer. Just to give you an idea of how hard it is to factor this number, when I was in Los Alamos, they were very proud of having one of the biggest computer systems in the world. They had about 10,000 PCs next to each other. It's called a Beowulf cluster. And they used this Beowulf cluster of computers to try to factor numbers, because it's some kind of benchmark to show how good they are at manipulating information. So they used these 10,000 computers for more than a few weeks doing only this, and they barely factored these numbers. When Peter Shor discovered this, it aroused the interest of the intelligence community around the world. People at the National Security Agency, or in Canada, Communication Security Establishment, started to worry, because these agencies have to certify cryptographical code for government use or private industry use in different ways. And they have to certify them up to the order of 25 years. So they started to wonder, if somebody can build one of those machines, our codes would not be secure. For your credit card, at least for mine, It'll have changed a couple of times before 25 years, or the time we build a quantum computer, so it doesn't matter as much. But there's some private information, for example, healthcare information. It would be incredibly useful to have health information on the web, because if you would have an accident up in Thunderbury, they can pull up your file over there. But if it is encrypted with RSA, then you should start to worry about it, because in 20 years, somebody can go back, or 15 years if we build a quantum computer then, somebody can go back and decrypt this. Think about information of companies, strategy of different companies that could be intercepted by other people, or national security information. So I was in Los Alamos, and the people from the National Security Agency came and to some of us and wanted us to answer the following question: will we be able to build a quantum computer in the next 25 years? And if the answer would have been, yes, we can do it in 1 year or two, all that work would have become classified, and I would not be here to talk to you about it today. If the answer would be, yes, in 100 years, they would not have been interested, I would not have been funded, and still I would not have been here again tonight. And the answer is, we don't know if we can build these machines so that we can factor a large number. What we know today is that we've made steps to show that very small of these devices, we can make them and make a first path in that direction. I mentioned cryptography, and I'd like to mention something which is local to here, the Cryptographical Center at the University of Waterloo, and in particular, the late Bill Todd, because in some sense, he is the grandfather of the quantum computing group here. Bill Todd was a chemist in Cambridge at the end of the 1930s, and he was very good at crosswords, and he got recruited to work at Bletchley Park during the Second World War to go and break codes, in fact, under the direction of Turing that I just mentioned. And it is the place where they broke the code called Enigma. Some of you might have heard about the Enigma. There's a movie recently about this. And that was a code which was used by the German army, and by breaking this code, apparently it did change or kind of shrink the amount of time that the war had to last. So Bill Todd was in this group. After having worked at Bletchley Park, he went to work in London, ended up in Waterloo, founded a group of combinatorics optimization here in the cryptography group. And the people around him knew that he was very, very smart and very, very good. And he had some kind of archangel around him to be sure that he was well taken care of. But nobody knew exactly what was a smart thing that he had really done. And he got known around 1995. They had broken a code called FISH, which apparently was much harder than the Enigma. And FISH was used by the high command of the German army. And nobody had known this until 1995. And the reason why nobody had known is that the British, who knew very well, was keeping on making cryptographical machines which used FISH, and they were selling it around the world. So they could know what these different people were talking about. And in my work recently, one other thing I've learned is another thing that Bill Todd had done during that time was to discover some kind of mathematical formula called the Todd polynomial. And in my work, I realized that the difficulty of simulating quantum computers, because it's very hard to do it in a classical computer, we'll see this a little bit later, it's equivalent to evaluate one of his polynomials. So it's a very hard task. And now let's pass on to try to understand how these quantum computers work. I already mentioned to you that classical computers are machines which manipulate strings of bits, strings of one and zero, and we compute, we just manipulate these strings of one and zero, and at the end we have some software which changes these one and zero into nice pictures, which tells us something. But the essential element of computing is a manipulation of zeros and ones. How do we do this? We have a set of gates, a NOT gate, which change a one to a zero, or a zero to a one. Or an AND gate, which takes two inputs, two numbers here, and the output here is zero, except when the two inputs are one. And with these two gates, we can put them all together, and we can do any kind of algorithm. So all the manipulation of all the information we have around is made by a few little gates. And this is pretty amazing. In fact, these gates are implemented physically by these transistors. So how do quantum computers work? Well, the idea here is not to have a bit, but a quantum bit. And I've already mentioned to you, when we look at this interference pattern of with these two slits, that these bits could be in the state 0 and 1 at the same time. So we can think about small quantum system. If you look at the nucleus of atoms, some of them behave like little magnets. If the magnet points up, it's a 1. If the magnet points down, let's call it a 0. And then we can put a little bit of 1, a little bit of 0, which could correspond an arrow in some kind of direction. So if we think about the classical world, we are at the North Pole and the South Pole of that sphere. But quantum mechanics allows us to be anywhere on that sphere. So there's more place where we can go and manipulate this information. Sometimes we can find maybe some shortcuts to do this. And the idea of this Shor factoring algorithm is really to find a shortcut because we can manipulate the information in a different way. Another way to encode this information would be in an atom, where the electron would be in this ground state. That could be the 0. The first excited states would be the 1. And we could get superposition of both of them. Then we have to manipulate them. And so we have learned that if we can manipulate this bit one by one, talk to the first one, then talk to the second one, talk to the third one without talking to the first one, keeping on like this, and then making them talk from neighbor to neighbor, then we can build any kind of algorithms. So we have one bit gate, talking to one at a time. Two bit gates means talk to their neighbors. Then we can go and do any kind of algorithm that we could imagine. In the classical computer, these two bit gates are made with little wires between these bits. In a quantum computer, we'll typically not have wires. We'll use the force of nature, and we'll see this in a few minutes. But the most important thing is that these bits can be superposed. So if we try to think of how powerful a quantum computer is, if we have a single quantum bit, it can be in 0 and 1 at the same time. So the number of classical bits that we need to describe this is roughly 2, because we have to describe the 0, we have to describe the 1. If we have 2 of these quantum bits, we can be in the 0, 0, we can be in the 0, 1, the 1, 0, and the 1, 1. So we need 4 quantum bits, 2 to the power 2. If we have 3 of them, then we have the 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, up to 1, 1, 1. There'll be 8 states. So to represent 3 quantum bits, we need 8 classical bits. Well, that's not a big difference. Let's go and do 4. Well, you can go along and calculate that for 4 quantum bits, you need 2 to the power of 4, 16 classical bits. So let's go and increase the number. We'll go and put 10 of them. 2 to the power 10 is about 1,000. It's about a kilobyte. A kilobyte of classical memory would need it to encode what we have in 10 quantum bits. Let's go with 20. 2 to the power 20 is equivalent to 1 megabyte. Only 20 atoms need 1 megabyte of information. If you're not that impressed, I'm going to go to 30. 2 to the 30 is 1 gigabyte. So if I take my best laptop and I put all the memory of it into that state of these 30 atoms, I get to 1 gigabyte. And if you're still not that impressed, I'm going to go and put 40. Then I have 1 terabyte, 1,000 gigabyte, or a million megabyte. And then with 50, then I'll stop, because there's no way you can think of any classical computer in the world who can have 1 petabyte of memory, of RAM memory. And even if progress goes on, we'll end up at the end of Moore's Law before we can do this. 50 atoms, so only 50 atoms, you cannot follow them with a classical computer. In fact, the thing is even worse than this, because I have to square it if we want to follow the evolution. This is only to know the state at a given time. So I hope from this, you remember one thing, that changing from classical to quantum information is not going like going from your Pentium 1 to a Pentium 2. It's a drastic change of the way we can manipulate and process information. All of this that I've said tonight up to now is all theory. it's a little bit like the Star Trek Enterprise. It's great, it's wonderful. If you would be in there, you would go very fast. But where are we in the experiment today? In a lot more humble state. In fact, some of my friends tell me that I'm pushing the case by showing somebody in bicycle. We're kind of learning to walk. And I'm saying this, we're learning to walk because these rules are different. We're really learning how to manipulate the systems. They are really counterintuitive. The way we've done things before, we have to relearn it. But this is the task ahead. And we can show in small devices that we can do this. And the one I'm going to explain is about nuclear magnetic resonance. So what I'm going to show you in the next few minutes is how we can use the magnets inside the nucleus of atoms to do a little bit of quantum computing. So if you look at some atoms, like hydrogen or carbon 13, like the isotope of carbon with one extra neutron, they behave like little magnets, and they can be in two states, zero or one. So I will use the word magnet or the word spins in the same way in the rest of the conversation. So in 1948, Bloch and Purcell went down to their lab and discovered that indeed they could measure the behavior of these little magnets. What they did was they put a set of atoms together in a sample which looked about that size, and they went to put it in the magnet. And if you remember very well your high school, there is this funny law that if you put a magnet, a small magnet, in a big magnetic field, there's the three finger rule. That is, if the field is up in the direction of your thumb, you put the small magnet in the direction of your index, the magnetic force is going to imply a torque in the direction which is perpendicular to the two. So this is going to make this magnet here, the small magnet, to move. But the torque is again perpendicular and perpendicular and perpendicular. So they are going to start to rotate. They are going to circle around at a certain frequency, which is called the Larmor frequency. The stronger that field, the faster is that frequency. So with this, Bloch and Purcell, what they did was to put their sample in a big magnet and then put a little coil that we've seen around here, a little coil. And you might remember that if you have a magnet which turns inside a coil, it induces a current in that coil. And they went to measure that current. And you know, what you see is a little pattern of things oscillating like this. And they want to measure the frequency of this oscillation, and they see that each frequency, they get little peaks, and this is a signal that they've measured these little magnets. So this was a way to go and observe them. Can we go and control them and make them compute? And that is, they've shown that this was possible. And the way is very similar of how they measured it. They went back to their little coil here, and they sent a current. Instead of going measure the current, they go and send a current at the frequency which was at this Larmor frequency, which is typical of one particular nucleus. And by this, it looks like a magnetic field in the frame which rotates with this Larmor frequency. And by sending this current, they started to be able to manipulate these little magnets. So there's a little movie here which shows this. So by sending a radio frequency pulse in a direction which is perpendicular to the z-axis, the vertical one, and the y-axis here, or the one which would be the x-axis, you can make these little magnets rotate around. By changing the time at which they rotate, they could make it go 180 instead of 360 degrees, or if you prefer, 112 degrees. By just make it go for a certain amount of time, you know that you can rotate in different area. By changing the timing at which they send this pulse, or what is called the phase, they can make a rotation around the x-axis or the y-axis. And by combining these two, you can make a rotation in any kind of direction. So with this, you can talk to one atom by sending the pulse at the Larmor frequency and make it rotate the way you want. The step after that is how do you make them talk to each other? And then you remember that I told you that this Larmor frequency depends on the strength of the field, of the magnetic field that you put in the background, the big magnet that you have around. If you have two of these spins or two of these magnets, and if this one points up in the same direction of the big magnets that you have in the background, it's going to make the field a little bit stronger, so this one will rotate a little bit faster. If it points down, it will reduce the background field, make this one rotate a little bit slower. So here's a little picture of this. The first spin, the first magnet is pointing up, the second magnet is pointing down, and the second spin, let's say the red one, the blue one will be the first one here, or another example is if it points down. If this, the red one is going to go a little bit faster, and here again I'm in the rotating frame of the average Larmor frequency. So it rotates at the same speed. So if it goes a little bit faster, it'll go anticlockwise. And the one which goes a little bit with a weaker field will seem to kind of drag on behind, so it'll look like it's going backward. So with this, we have a gate between two of these quantum bits. That is, this one being up or down is affecting this one differently. And this way is a way of transforming information from one place to the other. So that's how these quantum bits talk to each other, through the fact that they are little magnets and they are have an effect with each other. We don't need wires anymore. We use the fundamental laws of nature to make them talk to each other. I mentioned to you that we had this big, strong magnetic field in the background, and this is how to start the computation. You put a big magnetic field in the background. It'll make your little magnet behave like your compass. It will align itself with the field. So then we can, with this, align all these spins in the same direction and start the computation. I'd like to finish that slide by showing you a little movie of the lab where we're working at the Institute of Quantum Computing here at the University of Waterloo. So this is the electronics which sends these pulses that I've mentioned. This is the big magnet in the background. This is what is called a preamplifier, and the cable which sends these radio frequency pulses or observe the currents which comes out of the coil, which is hidden here in the middle of the magnet. This magnet has a field which is about 100,000 times the magnetic field of the Earth. It's made of superconducting material, which is cooled down to liquid helium temperature, which is about 4 or 5 degrees Kelvin. And we put about 100 amps of current in there. And because it is superconducting, there's absolutely no resonance, no resistance. And it runs essentially forever. Camille Negreveng, my postdoctoral fellow, is putting the sample just on the top, on the little red insert in there, and this a pneumatic system which brings the sample that you've seen a little bit before down to the middle of magnet. And this magnet is incredibly homogeneous. In the middle of it, we want to be sure that we're very, very field which is the same, very near these atoms. If I have this field which is 100,000 times the magnetic field of the Earth, this time it takes to do one turn of this small magnet is about a nanosecond. Our experiments last about a second when we do this computation. So we need to be precise in one part in about a billion. And to this, we want to be sure that everything is very smooth. In fact, sometimes we have trouble when there's a weather system which comes in. A weather system comes in, changes the pressure of the air, and makes the magnet move a little bit, and we can see this in our experiments. When there's a snowstorm, there is this the truck which clears up the snow next to the lab, and it's a big piece of metal which is coming around, and we can see it out of the experiments. So there's some time to time when we don't add 1 plus 1, which is equal to 2, we can think of having this, this truck is the troublemaker. So now what I want to do is to explain to you how we do a computation, all of this. And this was quite a challenge to me, to make a simple computation enough so that people have a rough idea of how we put all of this together. So we have these gates, we put them together. Can we do something interesting? What I'm going to do is a gate which is called a control nut. So I had these one-bit gates with this Larmor frequency. We had this interaction between the spins. And with this, I'll put them together and do what is called a control knot. This is a gate where if the first bit, the control, first quantum bit, the control, is zero, nothing is going to happen to the second one. So indeed, the first one is zero, we end up the same thing. But if the first one is one, it's going to flip the second one after the gate. For those who remember their binary numbers, what I'm doing is adding those two numbers and giving the answer on the last digit without the carryover, because the carryover starts to be a little bit more complicated. So it's really the basic. How can I combine different gates and make a gate of this form? Well, here's what we have. It's called a quantum circuit. Time goes this way. My different atoms, carbon or hydrogen, goes this way. And then this means a rotation by 90 degrees around the y-axis. This was the two-bit gates who makes them talk to each other. More rotation and go. If you're really good at multiplying matrices, you should have convinced yourself that indeed this was the right case. Or if I go in front of you and tell you I rotate that way, then you should follow this. But I thought it would be simpler to have a little movie which showed this. So what I'm doing here is following the circuit at the top. And I'm sure that everybody is stunned by now. I'm going to start at the beginning. So what I'm going to do is give two examples. The first one, which is here, when we start 0, 0, the two spins point up. And then the 1, 0, where the control points down, and then the targets point up. And at the end, what I want to show you is that this one is going to remain the same. But this one will end up with both spins pointing down. So I first told you that we have to do a rotation around the y-axis by 90 degrees. The y-axis is this one, the x-axis is this one, the z is vertical. So we do a rotation. So we bring this spin in this direction. So that's relatively easy. And then I say there was this two-bit gate. The control is pointing up here, so this one is going to go this way counterclockwise. This one is pointing down, it was going to go clockwise. And indeed, that's what you see here. And now we go a Z rotation for carbon, which is the control, and it's already in the Z direction. Nothing happens. We do a Y rotation of the other one, it's already in the Y direction, nothing happens. So we have only the X rotation. We put all of this together, and what you get is the following. And indeed, I ended up with 0, 0, which is here, and 1, 1, both of them pointing down. So this is your first algorithm. You've now graduated from quantum algorithm 101. The main idea here is that by manipulating these spins, we can make them go and do computation. And this is what I wanted to show. If you go to the lab, I should have mentioned when the movie was passing through that all of this is controlled by a classical computer. So the classical computer says to the quantum CPU, send this pulse and do this, wait a little bit for this two-bit interaction, send more pulse to do this and this. And at the end, what we see is the amount of signal at a certain frequency that we get out of the screen, which is what I'm showing here. So on the screen of the classical computer, this is the initial state of the 0, 0 when we are looking at the target bit, the hydrogen, which is in the state 0, and then the carbon, which we don't see, the control, is in the state 0. If we start like this, we do this experiment, and there's not that much to see. It's all of this in this machine. We just see the final state. What we should get is 0, 0, and the final screen, the final state is indeed exactly the same thing. Not that exciting. Not surprising, we started with 0, 0. The claim is that we should end up with 0, 0. The slightly more interesting one is when we start with the carbon, the control, which we do not see in the state 1. You can see a little bit that this has happened because the line has shifted, because the carbon is pointing down. It changed the frequency at which the hydrogen is. The initial state, however, is pointing up, corresponding to the 0. We go through this little algorithm again, and what you see, I've put the baseline up so that you can see something, so that it's not down in the, under me. So the thing has been flipped the other way. So this is the result of what we see when we go to the lab and we do this experiment in front of you. doing control not is the first gate, but certainly not the last that we want to do. And we have been able to make a series of different manipulations with different molecules. The molecule I'd shown you was chloroform. Here's the trichloroethylene and carbonic acid. And with this, we can manipulate them and go up to 7, 8, or 9 atoms and show that we indeed can control them. We can understand how this, the implication to try to simulate quantum system and understand them better. But most of the work that we do is really related to quantum error correction and really a demonstration of how we can control this system. I've mentioned to you that one of the great discoveries we've had in this field is to show that quantum information is a lot more powerful than classical information. But if we want to go into experiments, we also want to show that we can indeed do this, and a key to this is the control of quantum mechanical system. A few years ago, we've discovered how, in principle, we can do this. How we can do error correction with error or noise creeps in, how can we control it? And we've discovered some, in 1996 up to the year 1999, 2000, ways of how to do this. And this is really the key of taking advantage of these new technologies. And for you to understand, I'll go with an analogy of controlling various forces of nature. When people started to control fire, when fire was not something which happens when there is a forest which kind of get hit by lightning, but something that we can put around some bricks or rocks and control it, that allowed people to make some tools, people to gather, and then lead to agriculture, and then really a change in society. The same thing happened when people started to control steam. That led to the ability of making new machines, making tools in a much more efficient way, led to steam engine. Now we can go and take resources which are much further away, bring them. So now distance was not a problem anymore. Same thing happened with electromagnetism. These theories were discovered at the end of the 19th century. We started to control these fields at the beginning of the 20th century. That led to the radar, for example, in the Second World War, led to the information revolution that we have today. Where we are today with quantum mechanics and quantum system, it's really the start of a voyage on a land that we see where the shore are, but we don't know where the limits of this land are. And there are many discoveries that lie ahead. And that makes the journey very, very, very exciting. I'd like to sum up to tell you that many of today's technologies are going towards the quantum scale. Thus, we need to learn quantum mechanics and understand how it works. Quantum information takes this decrease as an advantage instead of an impediment. It allows to tackle tasks which seems mind-boggling with classical devices, but which becomes possible if we use these new rules of nature. I've mentioned mostly quantum computing, a little bit about quantum cryptography, but there's other technologies also that will come up. We're really at the beginning of this new era of tackling the quantum forces of nature. Here in Waterloo, we have efforts both at Perimeter Institute and at the Institute of Quantum Computing to try to understand what is the implication of quantum mechanics. What does this means for the universe, for reality, but also to turn this into devices that we can take advantage of. I'd like to finish by thanking the sponsors of the Institute for Quantum Computing, in particular the Perimeter Institute and Mike Lazaridis, whose vision has really led to the development of this group here in Waterloo. And finally, thanks my colleagues at the University at the Institute for Quantum Computing, and the students, the ones who are really doing all the work while I'm here giving these talks, but also are challenging my ideas, coming with their own, because really it is them who will see the quantum revolution. Thank you very much.
Always when we hear about new technologies, we hear what so good will come to humankind from it. Now, have you ever thought what bad can come out of this technology?
the good or the bad depends on how people want to use them. You have a car with you, you can do good things or you can do bad things. It depends really what the human people can do with it. One of the bad thing you might think of, for example, the quantum cryptography that I mentioned, would be that if the bad guys want to talk to each other, you won't be able to eavesdrop. Is this really a bad thing for most of us? Well, I hope we're all good people around here, are going to have a lot more privacy to do whatever we want. So indeed, there are possible, every time you have new technologies, there are new things that can, and people can use them in a bad way. But at the end, it is us, as human beings, who have to decide to use them the best way we can.
Yes, I just have a question about the difference between the nanoscale and the quantum scale, and the difference in the time horizons, if there are any.
So the nanoscale is on the way of going towards the quantum scale. So the nanoscale is probably tens or hundreds, a few hundreds size of atoms. It's the places where you can still think of your atoms of being little balls here and there, and you kind of go and manipulate them together. By going there to very small system, you can do new things, but it's still with the same ideas that we have been, or same technologies really that we've been using in the past. Think about the world as all being constructions of balls together that you can put things. If you push the nanoscales to its limit, where you go and end up in controlling the quantum effects themselves, then the world starts to change. And as I mentioned, you start to have these atoms being at two places at the same time. And this opens a new door. It's really a new land, which we haven't explored that much. I mentioned a little bit about this information, the impact it has when we try to manipulate information. But it's really the beginning. So we go from where we are today, slowly going towards the nanoscale. Then we are kind of just adapting today's technology to go to smaller systems. So instead of adding wires, we'll have carbon tubes, for example. But still the same idea that we have. And suddenly we have a break, which is very different when the quantum world comes and appears.
Where are the other centers of research in this field?
MIT, Caltech, Berkeley, Cambridge are the places where do works which are kind of comparable to what we're doing here. It's a very small community. If I count the number of people who do quantum computing in the world, I would say probably a few hundreds today. So it's a very small community. We talk to each other all the time. I was at the conference during the weekend in Montebello, where people came from Boulder, MIT, from England. So different places. We all know each other. We all tease each other. Help each other in different ways.
Just a question about the experiment itself.
Yep.
When you have, when you're manipulating the states of the atoms with the magnetic fields, are you manipulating a very small number of atoms and molecules, or are you manipulating billions of them and doing it all at once?
This is a very good question. We can do experiments where we can manipulate atom one by one. And there's a technology which I've not mentioned, ion trap, where indeed you go and touch one, do something with it, and read it off. In nuclear magnetic resonance, we don't do this. We have a lot of them. And when we manipulate them to do the computation, we put a lot of atoms. And the reason is, at the end, we want to read it off. The signal of a single atom is too weak to induce a current in that coil. So we put a lot of them, make them do all the same thing, and then we read off the answer. The quantum effects comes in when we have only a single, or within a molecule itself, and the atoms in the molecule go and talk to each other. And then all of this behaves quantum mechanically. But at the end, in NMR, the experiments I've mentioned, then we need a lot of them. We could do it one by one and just kind of repeat the experiments a lot of times. So the number of molecules that we manipulate at the end is about 10 to the 15, 10 to the 16 today.
The old PC that I have at home has a billion bits of memory. And it's actually kind of an old model. I was thinking a quantum computer with a billion quantum bits would be so powerful that I can't imagine what you could do with it. Are there any fundamental theoretical reasons why we may not ever be able to build such a computer?
We do not know of reason why we would not be able to build a quantum computer. So we've asked ourselves this in the community, is there a major roadblock which would stop this? And up to the theory of quantum error correction that I mentioned, the theory of controlling those quantum systems, the fact that we did not have the equivalent of error correction was a roadblock. Once we discovered this, the road seems to be free and open of the major roadblocks. In the day-to-day world, we start to increase the number of bits. We need to learn how to control larger and larger quantum system while keeping the quantum effects in there. And this doesn't seem to be fundamentally a problem, although to go from 10 quantum bits to 20 is still a step that we haven't done yet, because we need to learn all these tricks that we've learned in the classical world for many, many, many years. We have to adapt them for the quantum systems.
I'll ask more of a philosophical question, which I think a lot of us are thinking but don't want to ask. So what would stop us later on to believe that your son can be at two places at the same time? and I'm asking it in a very serious manner, although it's fun. But I mean, we didn't believe that you can have a bias when you're looking at particles, that they actually know you're around there to be doing that, yet it happens. So what would stop us later on to look ahead in so many years from now and see that we could actually do something like that?
It's a very good point. And maybe I can ask Patrick to come and answer that question. He might well give a much better answer than I would. The simple answer is we do these experiments, like these two-slit experiments. And there's a similar thing when I mentioned these NMR experiments that I've been doing where I was doing this control that. We do these experiments, and the only way we can explain them is by understanding that you are in zero and one at the same time. You might ask then, if we can do it with atoms, why can't we do it with very large systems? Because indeed, you are only at one place at a time, and I imagine that you think that I'm only at one place at a time right now. And the reason is that these quantum effects are quite fragile. To make them see at two places at the same time, you have to isolate them very, very well. And when you try to go to larger system, and that answered partly the previous question, when you try to go to larger system, then the fact that these systems are not completely isolated destroy the superposition of being in zero and one. And they seem not to be at zero and one at the same time, but in zero or one. You can stop seeing these things. So to make a quantum computer, we need to be able to make them in such a way that they're very, very well isolated from their surrounding. If you try or not isolated very well, then you lose this quantumness. And this is what the main challenge that we have experimentally is to build this larger and larger system while keeping them very, very, very well isolated. But to come back to the answer of how can you believe it, my only answer is come to the lab and see and try to explain the various facts that we have. It is a very counterintuitive theory because we've been born and we've been using the classical world every day. We've been trained by using these sets of rules which explain most of the things that happen around us. But when you go to the microscopic world, these rules fail. And you try to predict it by thinking of atoms as little balls being only at one place, and you cannot make explanation which fits the result of the experiments. In fact, it makes me think of the way to really bring this quantum revolution is to really start teaching quantum mechanics to the kids. And again, Patrick and Justin will tell you that I'm trying very hard.
Two
but
more.
Really, it's a different way of thinking. So we have to change our mind and try to make it so that we can adapt to these new sets of rules.
What is the role of the quantum teleportation in the quantum computing?
Very good. I should have had a slide prepared on quantum teleportation. So there, which is not an easy thing to explain in a few minutes, quantum teleportation is a way to manipulate information in such a way that if you try to think about classically, it doesn't make any sense. Information starts to go at one place, you put it there, you manipulate it with other quantum system, and it appears at another place. You try to think about this classically, it's like trying to think about somebody being only at one place at once. You really have to think about, yes, these particles are at more than one place at the same time. This is how you can explain these very unusual phenomena. What is the place for quantum computation? It is a way to send the information from one place to the other in a very, very efficient way, which has no classical analog. So that is the role of quantum teleportation. Although it's a beautiful word, it's a word, quantum teleportation, a set of words, which really grasp people's imagination because they think they are in Star Trek. Well, it's slightly different, to be honest. It's really a way of manipulating the information, not bodies of different people. So that's where the subtlety comes in. If you believe that really you are some of information, that I can calculate exactly where all your atoms are, and I can make you being reproduced here, this is a bit the equivalent of teleportation for the classical world.
But it appears to be that the vector of time is reversed in this effect. So how you can use it in that way?
Well, if the arrow of time reversed, it's great. And I would go back and buy some shares of RIM 3 years ago.
Sort of practical question. What's the state of the art today? How many qubits can you make dance in your lab right now?
About 10. So this is the number that we are around, between 7, 8, 9, 10. We can go and make them dance, and you tell me what kind of choreography you want, and I'm going to make it happen in the lab.
This edition of Celebrating Science has been made possible by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics through the support of private and public funding partners, including the Government of Canada and the Government of Ontario. To learn more about the Institute and to enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.